Hi, everyone, and welcome to another 10K Saturday. This week, you'll hear me, Lulu Picard, speaking with singer, coach, and my new teaching through quarantine war buddy, Tom Kulkazi. But before we let you in on the exotic places that Tom has been, let's chat about how you can have some amazing experiences and win some amazing prizes. Just go to 10kdollarday.com/omaze, that's O-M-A-Z-E, to win incredible stuff and things to do just for raising money for charity. For instance, right now you can support the Peterson Automotive Museum and be entered to win a DeLorean. What? Entries close January 7th, 2022, but that is in the future. Let's get back to the present and meet Tom, who puts the cool in Kulkazi. Here we go.
And now is 10K Saturday with Allison and Lulu.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of 10K Saturday. I'm very excited for you to meet my friend Tom. Wait for his last name. It's very exciting. But first, I'm going to say, here you are at 10K Saturday, which means you're not at 10K Dollar Day. Our normal episodes, which would be our signature imaginary luxury travel episodes, where we spend a fake $10,000 every single week in 24 hours somewhere. Does that sound crazy? It kind of is. It also means that you're not at our other podcast, Allison Burns and I have, which is The Daily Happy. It's a 10-minute podcast designed to help you wake up or wind down or whatever. But I am here with the maestro, Tom Kulkazi.
Hey, brava, brava, brava.
Grazie, grazie. I practiced. I really did.
Hi. It's so fabulous to be here with you. I'm so excited.
Well, Tom and I are Zooming right now, everyone, and that is the only way we've ever spoken to each other.
Welcome to the new millennium.
Oh my gosh, everyone, this is going to be a little bit fascinating for me as well as you, this interview, because cat's out of the bag. I don't know Tom very well, but I should, because Tom and I have been working together pretty closely the past week and a half. I've been in quarantine. However, we have been co-music directing a project together, and we just met virtually for the first time 10 days ago and then got thrown into the snake pit. Tom, how has it been for you?
It's been like Mr. Toad's wild ride, you know? Every day, something new. But luckily, we were thrown into each other's arms, and we both seem to operate well, even if we slipped on the banana peel. You know, it's like, whoops, okay, regroup. It's been wild, but I'm so grateful that I ended up in your backyard, because this has been a blast. I've had a great time.
Yeah, we've had a great time making up a singer camp for our singers. Tom and I have completely created a masterclass curriculum available to you anytime that anyone would like. However, Tom and I have been kind of leading a singer camp and also dealing with some really amazing material musically, but it's not the music that Tom trained in. And I really want to know, this man knows so much about his voice, everyone. It's incredible. So, Tom, I know that you have a performing career as an operatic tenor. I know that you have extensive training. So if you wanted to impress someone, like really, really impress someone,
Okay.
Tell me like the snootiest place you trained and the most zhuzhy role you've ever had.
I guess the snootiest place I trained was in Italy for a year. I mean, I went to school, obviously. I went to the Boston Conservatory and cross-registered between Emerson and New England Conservatory. So there was that time. But if you're talking real snoot.
Yeah, like super snooty.
It was an international program for opera singers abroad in a little town in Italy, just outside of Milan. It was called Chiari. And they had this wonderful program where people came from sort of all over as parts of different programs, like from Israel, from Germany, all over the place. And they brought us all together in this one place. And we did a series of concerts in this beautiful old villa out with an orchestra in front of the place. And then we did little mini tours around. So like my first week in Italy with these people, I was singing the lead in La Rondine and holding a bottle of champagne over my head, singing high B's. I was like, you know, crazy, crazy stuff. And then the fear factor of that, being in the place where the music was written, and with the people who know it, like we listen to the radio or we listen to our podcasts or we listen to music all the time. These people know the words to all of these operas. And who am I? This, like, you know, this American guy coming in, doing this in front of people, like it literally in their backyard. You know, it was crazy. So, but it was an incredible time. And I got to work with people from La Scala and L'Opera and Covent Garden. And I wish I could rewind and go back. This is how much fun it was. And just snooty, I guess, but in the best possible way.
Oh, trust me.
Yeah.
It's the best snooty. I mean, you just you just justified, as soon as you said villa, I think everyone was like, this is going to be a great story.
Villa, the double L and the nice... perfectly delicious, bright E.
So, yeah, I know. It's amazing. And opera, you've now moved to coaching singers in musical theater, cruise ships, all that kind of stuff. Opera is like a different world. We have had opera people on the podcast before. Mm-hmm. But what's like the main differences, even just in the gig? I know that opera people... the runs are shorter, right? Like you perform less, but it is a much more athletic kind of thing. Is there any sort of preparation in the day that's different, you think, for an opera singer?
I find, yeah, because I've had the luxury of having done musical theater stuff and opera stuff. There was one point where I was doing a production of Trovatore in New York City, and I had to warm down my voice to go to bed, warm up my voice slightly in the morning for coffee. I had three warm-ups in the day. It was like a morning warm-up, an afternoon kind of let's see what the heck is going on warm up, and then the warm up I did before the show, all in the for the purposes of not spending too much time in that sort of compressed sort of operatic field, but to sort of be relaxed in it. And as the day goes on, kind of turn the screw a little tighter till we got to the performance. And it's very interesting. I don't know that we do this in musical theater, but like in a, say a through composed show like Miss Saigon or Les Mis or something like that, or Phantom, where there's not lines, but not many lines, but, or just completely sung. In the opera, we often will use the first scena or the first scene to sort of warm ourselves into the opera. So you warm up as much as you need to for all the colors and all the stuff. And then you find your way in the scene often, not always, but often to lead you to the first aria, which you should be full blown ready at that point. So it's a strange sort of a meandering warm up that takes you to the very first big solo that you might have in the opera itself. And for some characters that could be 2 hours in, for some characters that could be a half an hour in. If you're doing Wagner, maybe it's 3 hours in, you know. It's Olympic because of the nature of the sort of protracted way that you sort of have to think of everything. It's not just a few scales and you're on, right? Yeah, no, 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 it's not like that at all. It's very much more like long lines. Everything is sort of in time and space, and everything is sort of smeared over your clock over the long haul, so that you're by the end of the day, you're hydrated, you're stretched, you're all ready to go. You know,
yeah. It's funny because I think a lot of people look at performers and they go, "Well, you work 3 hours a day,
right?"
And you're like,
right.
"Well, but I'm."
I'm putting out in those 3 hours.
Well, but not only that, but like I'm physically prepping myself,
yeah,
for that, for the 6 hours before that or the 7 hours before that. It's a very strange, everyone, Tom and I have been deep into this conversation of what it means to be an artist and how to mentally prep yourself and what the rituals are. It's really what we've been talking about this entire week in our rehearsals. So we're a little bit primed for that conversation, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah. When did you know that you loved classical music or opera? Was that in your home when you were growing up, or did you come to it on your own?
No, I was the kid who was plunked on the table at age 5 singing along with Mario Lanza. My grandmother was a huge fan of Enrico Caruso, who was arguably one of the most important tenors of the 20th century. If not, if you don't agree with that, it might be that he was the most recorded or the first very recorded tenor of the turn of the century, like 1905, even 1900 to 1910. And so you could buy an album with Enrico Caruso singing, and he became very famous very quickly. So much so that if you went to the Met, you asked for the next Enrico Caruso performance. You didn't even care what the opera was. You just bought the next time he was performing. So it was like the first sort of famous person coming out of technology or the newer technology in the time. So my grandmother had a complete Caruso collection on 78, and she had an old Victrola, and she would put the records on, and I probably was singing along with him. But when my mother introduced me to Mario Lanza movies, I was fascinated by the way that his voice expanded. And so I probably learned more from him, just trying to emulate, trying to sound like him. And because it was in my house, it was legal, right? It was like everyone kind of knew it. Everyone kind of was like, well, that's what we do. And like, so my parents didn't listen to the Beatles. They didn't listen to Streisand. They didn't listen to Neil Diamond. I was born in the 60s. I was raised in the 70s. My father was a big band freak. So we had a lot of jazz and big band in the house. And then we had this whole classical element. And my mother, I think, probably knowing that I had a sort of facility for it, kept it alive by feeding me bits of Mario Lanza movies, because back in the day, you couldn't, before video, right? If it was on TV, you had to watch it then. You couldn't record it. So I would often get a little poke on my shoulder at like 1 in the morning. My mother maybe had some insomnia. I know, crazy, right? Some insomnia issues. But I remember seeing The Toast to New Orleans with Mario Lanza, and I think it was Anne Blythe who plays opposite him, and fell in love. Just fell in love with the whole thing.
That's such a cool memory, though, to have.
And what kind of fun mother is like, this movie's on, you have to come see it. Having said that, she also did it with, I remember she specifically did it with Streisand's On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. In the middle of the night, I got a tap on the shoulder, and she's like, oh, you have to see this one. It's about past lives, which is also.
I think that's the only way anyone's ever seen On a Clear Day is like at 1 in the morning.
You're probably right. You're probably right.
So I'm fascinated because I love that your heart lives in the classical world. And I love classical music, but I grew up with it in the house and I grew up playing it. So people who see it as inaccessible or who just didn't grow up with it around them and they're curious about it, what do you think is a great way to start listening to that?
That's a wonderful question. I think, often my friends will come to me and say, I've got to go see an opera. I want to go see an opera. I've got to. They're being forced somehow. They're being told they have to go. And they're like, what should I see? And there are hard and fast rules. There are bread and butter shows that you want to see probably before you see like a Shostakovich or even a Tchaikovsky at this point. But like a Bohème, right? It's like everyone's first. Butterfly can be wonderful first. But in terms of access, gosh, it's kind of all about where I am in the moment. There are wonderful composers that like Reinaldo Hahn, who was composing in the late 1800s, who wrote lots and lots of music, who years ago, there was an article in the New York Times about him, and that's how I even discovered him. And it was about how if his music was really art song, or if it was something else, if it was so theatrical that perhaps it was like musical theater or some sort of other kind of music. So a composer like Reinaldo Hahn, even though he wrote in the Belle Époque period in the late 1800s, and he was the conductor for l'opera at the time. He wrote incredible, almost Sondheimian, if that's even a word, conversations between the voice and the piano that are very ear friendly. Not like Strauss or even Wagner or sometimes Schumann. I find it's like it kind of goes on a bit, right?
It's just like scales upon
Yeah,
scales
you don't
upon
want that.
scales. themselves.
Yeah, and Han, even though it's in a foreign, these particular songs are written in French. They're done to this day by many, many mezzo-sopranos and tenors to this day. And if you look online, you look up Rinaldo Han, you'll find all these beautiful songs. So I think he is a great way in if you enjoy sort of what you might call French parlor music. I've always found sort of Verdi to be, and Puccini to be a good way in. Verdi sort of for the repetition and the fun of the pyrotechnics of it, and Puccini for the very lush sort of orchestral. If you're an orchestral person.
Oh, it's so romantic, too. Oh,
it's ridiculous.
It's the most swoony music.
It truly is. And when you go, I communed, I call it communing with the maestro. I went to Lucca and spent a week just by myself, immersed in the language. And every night there's a Puccini concert there. And you go and you just listen and you're just awash with all of these incredibly emotional, incredible, expanded, like magnified emotion, very Italianate sensibility. And I think I will amend what I said. I think Puccini's always a great way in. Always, always, always. Just because it's hummable. I mean, so hummable that Andrew Lloyd Webber found his way to use some of it for, you know, a lot of his material. And I'll never forget the time I went to the Met and I saw Plácido Domingo singing La Fanciulla del West, The Girl of the Golden West. And I had never seen it before. I'd never heard. I knew like a couple of the arias because I was studying those. But he gets to this point where he's in the middle of the opera where he starts going, da 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 da. I'm like, what? I was like, are you freaking kidding me right now? I could not believe it. You know, I had always heard, you know, maybe he borrowed some themes or whatever. I'm like, the borrowing of a theme, but this is full on pluck out, stick in. And I was blown away. So I think when you listen to Puccini, I think there's a lot of wonderful things. There's a quartet in La Rondine, which if this isn't Angelo Weber, I don't know what is. Bevo al fresco sorriso, if you look it up. I drink to your beautiful smile, right? And this is the aria I was singing, the quartet I was singing in that piazza when I had my champagne bottle that night. And when you listen to it, it could be a musical theater piece just happens to be in Italian. It's just that beautiful. And opera people know about it, right? But it's not something that gets to the masses like it does in Italy. And in Italy, the first question they have when you go to a town is you say they see you a little bit. You know, when I was living there for a while and you walk into the store to buy bread and they go, ciao, oh, tenore. They listen to your voice and they want, you must be with the group that's here. And are you a tenor? You know, it's like a national pastime. It's fascinating. It's like so Shakespeare cool. In the UK or football in anywhere in Europe. It's opera is a big thing. Yeah.
We have a little bit of that with barbershop here.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, where you're talking about like, oh, there's a catalog of arrangements that they just kind of know. And if you're a tenor walking down the street, they might ask you to sing with them. There won't be.
I don't even know if I answered your question. Did I answer your question?
I don't Puccini. Even know what the question was. Oh, right. Puccini.
Possibility. I say no. Rinaldo Han and Puccini.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. I feel like I've heard sopranos sing something by Han, but I can't remember what it is. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like Puccini is a really great entry drug because it just gets in your head.
Sure.
You recognize all the emotions. You felt them all when you were 16 at that level. You know, like, yeah. All
yeah, and if you've never, just watch Moonstruck and watch Cher experience Bohème. I cry at that same point. Every time I see Bohème, I cry at that same point where she's saying, it's okay, let's separate without rancor, you know, without any, let's just forget each other. Heartbreaking. In the best way.
Tom, yeah. Passionate about opera. It's so cute. I love it. I just want to watch it with you because I feel so unversed sometimes.
Oh, we should go sometime together. I took my parents. I bought them tickets to see Traviata at the Met. They had never been before. They would never spend the money, right? It was very, very expensive. And it was the Zeffirelli production, which was like a moment-to-moment, like sunrise, sunset in Act Two. Like the sun came up at the top of Act Two and the sun shifted focus. And by the end of Act Two, the sun was setting and she sings, she knows she has to leave. He doesn't know she has to leave. And she grabs him and sings this main theme, which is love me, remember to love me. Right. And I warned my parents in advance. My mother was ugly crying because they speak Italian, right? So there's that. There's
Your parents speak Italian, you mean?
Yeah. My father's no longer with us. He spoke the Sicilian dialect. My mother speaks the Neapolitan dialect, which is a whole other language unto itself. I'm trying to learn, but it's crazy. I know all the swear words.
Good son. You're a good son.
I'm a good son. Yeah. It was wonderful to see these two little old Italians be overwhelmed by something they had no idea. So if you've never been to the opera and you've never experienced it, it's hard to describe the size of it until you go and you sit there and the sound literally washes on you. You can feel the air move with the sound over you. It literally washes over you. It is not just an audio, but a physical, palpable experience. I wish that everyone has the opportunity to go and feel what that is. If you love the symphony and you love people singing, suddenly together you have the two happening simultaneously. It's with costumes and mansions flying in the air and, you know, people flying in the air. And it's incredible. It's incredible.
Well, and real quick before we shift over to the second portion of the interview, since we're talking about this and you're talking about like the opera and this wash of sound, let's talk about the fact that when people see a musical, it's a lot of digital sound. But when they go see an opera, what's the difference of what they're hearing?
Well, in the opera, of course, it is completely acoustic, right? It's so strange because in America, we compare things to the Met, right? The Met, which is this giant barn of a place. Most opera houses in Europe are not that size. They're quite smaller and acoustically maybe easier to manage if you're singing acoustically without a microphone. The Met is a special place. It's got its own special acoustic. It's very humbling to stand in front of 30 pieces of orchestra behind you and have to make a sound that carries over that and into a space. So that's what's happening in the opera. There's no microphone. We're shouting over a lush and very dynamic orchestration. In the musical theater, we are, well, I guess, helped, right? There are many incredible musical theater singers who don't need a microphone, right? But in a sound design of a piece where maybe you have to feel like you're in a particular place or a particular time, they can do some pretty amazing things by creating an acoustic in the sound design that you then sing in. So we talk a lot about, a sound designer I work with talks about exciting the microphone, singing in such a way that the microphone has many colors to choose from. And that is the best possible scenario for me when I work with musical theater people. It's like, sing past the microphone. Use your gift to sing past the microphone. And then you're not trying to like micromanage notes or sections or things. Yeah. Are there parts that are going to be technical? For sure. There are in anything that you do, right? But you don't want to sing a whole, we've had this conversation, you and I already, but we don't want to sing a whole show where you have to micromanage absolutely everything. So the microphone can be a help for sure, but also maybe a hindrance, maybe a crutch, maybe a thing that can get in the way of us singing with the most amount of resonance. Because we're like, well, I've got a mic right here. Or Linda Eder, how many did she have? 5 in her hair, 4 in her hair? I forget how many she wore for Jekyll and Hyde. But just in case one went off or whatever, that was part of the sound design. So there's someone else controlling your EQ, right? There's someone else controlling the colors that are spinning out of your mouth. And you and I have both been in the position to sit out in the house and listen to maybe a singer manage something and go, can you sweeten that up? Can you fatten that up? Can you shine that up? And sound guys are like, can I shine that up? Where's Mr. iPad? I'm going to spin this dial and flick this lever. And it's truly amazing what can happen. I have a lot of friends that went through the Les Mis machine and they talked a lot about it didn't matter how they were singing. They were going to sound like they were on the album anyway, because the sound design compressed and put them in that box. That's what they were. It was the sound design branded the performance before you even opened your mouth. Technologically, I mean, they have rooms now. I think it's Sony, JBL. I forget who. There's a room in Seattle. A wonderful mezzo soprano named Stephanie Blythe did a recording of American music, and she did it in this room that it can. It's like a dead room, but they can through technology turn it into any acoustic they want. So it's like a giant. The room is a microphone. So if you if you wanted to sing live in that room, you could be put in any sort of milieu or environment in the sound environment that you wanted. Now they can do that with process anyway, but to be able to stand in the room and use the acoustic, even though it's digital in the room, is pretty humbling. I forget the name of the album, but if you look up Stephanie Blythe, it's she does songs by Kate Smith and all this wonderful stuff. And she talks a lot about the room and working with the technology. It's fascinating.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah.
Okay. We're about to go into our 10K5. Tom has asked to get these on the fly. It's always my favorite way to do it anyway, just because I just get tickled with these questions. All he knows, everyone, and by the way, all anybody knows if they've never listened to this before and they say, what kind of questions are these? I tell them that they are icebreaker questions that you can have on the fly or in advance that you would ask as an icebreaker. The funny thing is, Tom doesn't know what they are, but everyone else listening does. And now you know how fun that is.
I didn't even like Google them. I didn't even like go. I didn't even know this was happening. So I'm sort of excited. It's just going to be boom, 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 yep, whatever comes out. Peek.
It's going to be great. Okay, here's the first one. We're going to start easy. Tom,
Kulikazi. Okay.
What are you obsessed with right now?
Cooking.
Ooh.
Yeah. During the pandemic, lots of people were doing sourdough. I was learning how to make pasta with a friend of mine who's a chef in Bologna, Italy. I am obsessed with all the gadgets. I can make spaghetti alla chitarra. I make my own sfoglia. I roll it out myself on my table in the middle of my kitchen. Tortellini, cappelletti, you name it. I'm sort of in love with pasta making. And if you've never seen the documentary by Evan Funke, who's also a pasta maker. He has a restaurant out in LA. There's a documentary called F-U-N-K-E, Funky. He pronounces it Funky. And he goes around Italy to all these little old ladies and learns all these shapes that would be lost had he not shown up to, you know what I mean, that aren't being passed down because people don't want to learn anymore. So I have to say it's a combination of this work and Pasta Grannies. If you've never seen Pasta Grannies on YouTube, go down the rabbit hole. This British woman decided to put all these old ladies on video and have them make their best dish. So it's what they say in Italy, the cucina di casalinga, the kitchen of the housewife, or the food of the housewife. There's no recipe. They just do like grandma and they make it. And some of these women are 100 years old.
That's so cool.
It's fascinating. Pasta Grannies and Evan Funke. Go for it. I'm obsessed.
That's a good obsession. Okay. Tom Kulikazi, what's on your wish list?
What's on my wish list? Like in life?
However you interpret that question is correct, my friend.
Well, the big dream for my husband and I has always been to move to Italy. I have lucky enough to be able to get my dual Italian citizenship. That our country recognizes it. They don't get in the way of it. You can have both. The object would be to buy a place to live there, maybe a couple places. Maybe we rent some out and we live in one and live there maybe most of the time and come back and be with family. So having family there and living there and being sort of immersing ourselves in the culture. Jeff is in it. That's my husband's name, Jeff. And he's learning Italian. He's actually quite good. For someone whose name does not end in a vowel, he and did not grow up with it, he's really has a facility for it. So that's a wonderful thing. So I have my appointment for my passport in April of next year. I have all my documenti. Everything is set. I just have to get it and then we're off.
Okay.
I have to say this, and I don't say this to everybody, but I would send you a key.
You sweet man.
My aunt's getting a key. My mother gets a key. Jeff's mother gets a key. I would send you a key and say, come on, whenever you can.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I would keep it safe. I would keep it
safe. I know you would. I know you would.
The next question, I'm glad that you've already answered move to Italy, because it could also answer this next question, but I challenge you to find a different one.
Okay.
So, Tom, what would you do if you had an extra $10,000 that you had to spend in 24 hours?
Oh, my gosh. You know, my first instinct is that it should go to the Italian fund, but 10 grand... You know, I love my piano. I have a 1906, Jeff would have to correct me on that, Steinway M. It's an incredible, incredible, it's an incredible shape. It's still a Steinway. It's got all Steinway parts, but I want something new. And I think I might take that 10 grand and put it toward the Bechstein that I've always wanted. I want a German piano so bad. We've talked in Singer Camp about chiaroscuro, right? Bright and dark. German pianos are like bells with this dark, luscious, so dark. Yummy. Ugh.
So it's so funny. I am the opposite. I am the opposite, my friend. I'm so sorry, listeners. This is going to get a little MD dorky. Just give us like 15 seconds. But at my college, I went to Stetson University. They have a Bösendorfer that has the extra octave on the end.
Yeah, Bosies are excellent.
No use for. I don't understand. It's just rumble. It's like rumbly and matumbly the whole time. Give me a mellowed, broken in Yamaha Grand anytime. That's my baby.
You and Melissa Manchester. I got to work
with her.
She's not a Steinway fan. She loves a Yami. Loves a Yami. And I, you know, they're the workhorse of our sort of piano nation, right? But listen, a Bosie would be great, but there's something about a Bechstein that just gets me all like twittery.
Nerdy conversation. So stupid. People are like, are you guys kidding me? Are you done yet?
Yeah. Is this over yet?
All right. So that's what you would do with $10,000. So Tom, what would you do if you had $10,000 to give away?
That's a good question too. I have right now a niece who's gone into art school in Manhattan. And I think I would send it her way. She's the first one in her family to go out and to do college. My sister did college, but she did like post university, and she did like a 2-year program, and she's done really great. My sister's brilliant, but her daughter is out there working her bliss, right? I think I would throw her the 10 and say, put it in the bank, and it's just there for you to whatever you need in the year. I think I might do that. Yeah. She's a really cool chick. I love this kid.
If your niece ever listens to this, honey, if you see a Bechstein in your uncle's house, it could have been you.
It could have been you, Mags. Could have been you, Maggie. Of course, 10,000 won't even touch like the bench for the Bechstein, but that's all right. I'll get my damn bench.
All right. The last question is one that you are actually quite familiar with, even if you didn't know you were, Tom. What's your happy?
Oh, my gosh. Besides my husband, I would say my two pugs. My two pugs are consistently my happy. Edward and Bella. We rescued them from a lady about 6 months ago, and they had lots of issues. But they remind you that everything is supposed to be in joy. You're supposed to be in joy and celebration of life at all times. So everything we do, it's go pee-pee outside. Yay! It's a celebration. You know, it's time to eat. Yay! Celebrate. Time to go to bed. Oh, let me get my baby. Edward will take he has a little tiny stuffed pug, puts it in his mouth, trots over to the edge of the bed and sits and waits for me to pick him up to put him on the bed so he can go to bed with his baby in his mouth. It's ridiculous, and they're the sweetest little creatures in the world. I just love them. They're my happy.
They sure are. That's really awesome. I'm thrilled that you did this with me. Thank you so much for giving me your time. And I should say this also, thank you for being the most amazing colleague in one of the most stressful weeks of my life.
Gosh.
And I've learned so much from you in this past week. I've learned physical things from you. I've learned teaching things from you. I've learned life things from you. I learned to put 15 minutes in between appointments of students. I learned that from you.
Self-preservation, mommy. Self-preservation.
Oh my gosh. No kidding. No kidding.
Well, this has been a joy. I was so well chuffed when you asked me to join you in the first place. I was like, oh, a podcast?
A podcast?
How very, very technologically advanced, you know? But you've just been a joy. You've just been a joy, and you are so flexible. Like just not just your voice. Like I know I commented on your voice at one point. The flexibility of your voice is like crazy, y'all. If you've not heard her sing or speak, it's like
they hear me speak all the time. It's literally a podcast.
The range is crazy.
All they do is hear me speak.
What do you have? Like 5 octaves? It's nuts. It's nutso. Just in your speech. But you're just so giving. And I said this today when we said goodbye to our kids, you know, for the last time, you said goodbye, I move on with them. But this stuff would not have happened had you not nurtured the idea and said, hey, have you thought about what if we did this? Because it was all your idea. I don't know if you remember, but it was all, it all came out of you. It did not come out of me. And I had just gotten off a plane from Copenhagen. I was like, what day is it? What time is it? Oh, my foot hurts. What's going on? And you're like, singer camp. And I'm like, singer camp? That's great. Let's do it. So I thank you.
Oh my gosh, you got thrown headfirst into my craziness. And all of like the regular listeners are like, this poor man, because they know me so well. But
no, yes, y'all.
Thank you. It was a great partnership.
A gift.
Tom, if people would like to follow you, if they would like to find you, what's the best way to do that?
Well, I have a food blog. Remember I said about I have a food blog with my partner, who's also my sister-in-law and my best friend from grammar school. it's called, it's Salt Onion Moon, all one word, www.saltonionmoon.com. Great recipes from the Italian Casalinga, from the little old lady school of Italian cooking from me, and wonderful, wonderful, incredible baking from my sister-in-law, Kim.
What a cool project to have with your sister-in-law.
Not music at all, right?
I know, I love it.
Music of food.
Did you know that I collect cookbooks? We'll talk about this offline. Okay.
Oh my God, I have a sickness.
We'll talk in just a second.
Yeah.
We'll talk in just a second. Okay, everyone, as you can see, Tom and I have to go because we have lots of things to talk about still, even though we did just talk for 40 minutes. Everyone, you're amazing. Thank you for giving me an excuse to have the most amazing conversations with people in my life. I hope that they bring you a little bit of joy. As always, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter at $10K Day. We think you're awesome. So thanks for being here. Tom, say bye.
Ciao. Ciao. Tutti. Ciao. Ragazzi. Ciao.
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 That was 10K Saturday with Allison and Lulu. And don't forget, with friends like us, who needs amenities?